The Unmaking of America, a conversation with Kurt Anderson. You may know Kurt Anderson as an author and journalist who served as host of the Peabody Award-winning public radio program Studio 360. In his latest book, Evil Geniuses, The Unmaking of America, A Recent History, Anderson makes the case that a confederacy of the rich right began a methodical effort to take over the U.S. economy in the 1970s and 80s, making themselves even richer and creating the foundation for chronic inequities that we witness today. I'm Keith Shortall, and today we'll talk with Anderson about the hyper-capitalist crusaders who were the architects of this campaign, how he believes they pulled it off, and how they still have their hands on the controls. Kurt Anderson today on Maine Calling. First, this news. I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. In his new book, my guest makes the case that America's economic system was at one time more equitable than it is today. We'll ask Kurt Anderson to explain how a transformation from the New Deal to a raw deal took place, beginning 50 years ago or so, and what, if anything, can be done to change that. For two decades, Anderson was the host of the award-winning public radio program Studio 360. He also co-founded the satirical Spy magazine. He's the author of numerous books and has just come out with Evil Geniuses, The Unmaking of America, A Recent History. As always, we want to hear from you. Are you concerned about the growing income inequality in our country? And how do you think we ended up with our current economic system? Email us. talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or just give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Kurt Anderson, welcome to Maine Calling.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So the very first few words that greet the eye in Evil Geniuses are in this quote by the progressive attorney and big business critic Louis Brandeis, which states, We can have democracy in this country, or we can have great wealth concentrated in the hands of a few, but we can't have both. Explain why you chose to lead with that, and talk about that as an idea that maybe you believe we as American citizens should spend more time with.
Mm-hmm. Well, he, of course, was a Supreme Court justice as well, and was writing right around the time of the Depression and the New Deal. The New Deal, of course, didn't just come out of nowhere. It came out of a growing tradition of America's progress economically and citizens arising to kind of be a countervailing force to the power of big business. And the New Deal, in so many ways, empowered workers with minimum wage laws and allowing them to organize unions and so forth. So that's what he was saying that from. So we had the New Deal, and we had all of its years and decades of success, where a huge middle class grew and income equality got more and more through the 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s. And in addition to inequality, which we talk a lot about, security. Economic security was increased by means of pensions and affordable health care and all of the rest. America was getting economically better and better and better. And then, starting in the 70s and certainly ratified in the 80s, it changed. The paradigm shifted. And that's why I say the New Deal was sort of stopped in place and in many cases rolled back. And we got this new raw deal that happened by means of 100, 1,000 different changes in rules and laws and tax codes and tax rates and norms, importantly in norms, and the way we thought about whether or not we were all in this together or whether we were all individuals and screw your neighbors. And that's my basic story. And you know, I too was, as I say in the book, I mean, I was oblivious. I was doing okay. I didn't really notice what was going on and all the changes that were made and how the system was fundamentally changed. And then, you know, around the turn of the century, kind of woke up and started doing the research and was continuously amazed at what I discovered.
So I guess we could all put ourselves in that same same position. Those of us who are of a certain age remember, even vaguely, the big social and political transitions that are going on from the 60s and then into the 70s and the 80s. But maybe we just, you know, looked at that as part of this historical pendulum swing, you know, from the from the 60s, from free love to greed is good, and that just happened. But you make the case, here that there was more to it, and that this sort of class of the right rich, if there was a pendulum, really leaned into the pendulum and swung it hard.
Exactly right. I mean, there was, and there had been course corrections before after the New Deal. There was one in the late 40s and early 50s, and course corrections are fine and to be expected. This was something different. For one thing, there was no gigantic crisis like the Depression or like we have now, which, you know, crises that often provoke a pendulum swing from one way to another and a different way of thinking about how we live together in a society and all that. In this case, there was high inflation and there was a high oil prices. There were some problems, but it wasn't a giant crisis. And this and what I grant is a kind of natural after the 60s, let's stop with the new and calm down and maybe everything wasn't so bad and we can act normally. They just exploited that to an incredible degree. And as you say, instead of just going with the pendulum swinging, took it and essentially fixed it in place at the other end of the swing. And it has been there in terms of the how we think about our economy and fairness and what the government can do or can't do just became permanently changed. It was a big paradigm shift that, you know, from what had lasted really for the whole 20th century and certainly since the New Deal until it was changed at the end of the 70s and beyond.
So let's talk about this this team, this confederacy of evil geniuses. Who were they?
There were a lot of different people. And it wasn't as though I've always been kind of an anti-conspiracy theorist. Looking at this work and doing this research made me think, this isn't maybe a conspiracy like we think of it, a secret group of men in a room. But it was more like that than I ever realized. So Milton Friedman, the libertarian economist who was on the fringes, really, even though he was at the University of Chicago in the 60s and then became famous around 1970, he was, I would say, one of the original evil geniuses and then got the Nobel Prize in economics as well. In terms of the intellectual idea behind it, which is to say that only profits matter, business has no other responsibility to anybody or anything, whether it's racial equality or environmental protection or anything else. That was his idea, and the rest of the evil geniuses took it and ran. There are the various billionaire right-wingers, some of whom, like Charles and David Koch, people have heard of, others they probably haven't, but who got together and separately and together spent hundreds of millions and ultimately billions of dollars on lobbying and influencing, giving money to colleges and universities to push their way of thinking about the economy. There was the creation of new conservative and right-wing media empires, obviously starting on talk radio with people like Rush Limbaugh, but then with Fox News, and on and on and on. In so many ways, it happened on Wall Street as well. Well, at the same time, Wall Street changed from what it had been up through this time, the early 70s, as I described, to something very different, where it was no longer about restraint and prudence, but it was about go-go recklessness and about Wall Street and the stock market becoming more dominant in the real economy than it ever had been. And so there were all these changes that together, and there was it was a confederacy, which I like that word, and I use it a lot in the book, more than conspiracy, because they were affiliated, and they were all playing the same long game. First, to stop what some of them were afraid in 1970 was about to be a socialist revolution in America that would wipe them away. And then, when they were so successful so quickly and had their eye on this prize, of making the rich get richer and the and big business more powerful. They just kept at it, and they won. And they, as Warren Buffett, my fellow Omahan, said a couple of generations later in the early 2000s, there's a class war, and it's my class, and we're winning, and we shouldn't be. And that's what happened. And back when he said that, I thought, oh, that's funny, Warren. But I realized it was more literally true than I knew.
And there was a playbook to this, right? So you're mentioning this, the sort of strategy of media taking over media, the judiciary not taking over, yep, but being getting influence into. And this all goes back to this document, this memo, yep, written in 1971 by a man who, by Lewis Powell, who would later become a Supreme Court justice, but who was not really a conservative, right? He was a moderate. How did he end up being the architect of this grand plan?
Yeah, it's very interesting. He was a Democrat, but a moderate Democrat, but a moderate Democrat whose clients were big corporations, especially the big tobacco companies, who were being hammered, of course, in the 60s and 70s, early 70s, by the federal government, and he got freaked out by the protest on campuses and the turning Ralph Nader into a hero and all the rest. And so he drafted, and he was commissioned by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in 1971 to draft this 40-odd page memo, and it's extraordinary. It's extraordinary because, in retrospect, it was so successful, and it's such an uncanny description in so many ways of what happened, of how they would affect the law, as you say, CEOs of the biggest corporations would start lobbying personally in Washington to get their way, not just for their companies, but for the whole big business system, and on and on and on. So it is amazing. And there are other memos. There was another memo that I hadn't read and is even less well known than the Lewis Powell memo, which was funded by one of these right-wing billionaires in 1979 and 80, came out and said, okay, here's how we're going to take over the law. Here we have to recruit people from the best law schools. We have to have chapters of some kind of organization in every good law school. We have to embed them in the judiciary, and on and on and on. Well, a year later, there was the Federalist Society, and voila, more than a third, close to 50% at this point, of the federal judiciary are affiliates or former affiliates of the Federalist Society. So that worked too. It's not a conspiracy the way we think about it, because most conspiracies, either in conspiracy theories or in fiction, are secret and dark and shadowy. And there's some darkness and shadowiness in this one, but most of it was in relatively plain sight. After a year of being confidential, the Lewis Powell memo was leaked to the press and it was public. It was not really hiding in plain sight kind of thing. And as you said at the beginning, a lot of us, people thought, oh, no, this is just the way it goes. The pendulum swings back and forth. What are you going to do? But there was this set of game plans and playbooks, and they were followed and kept being followed and kept being funded. And here we are.
And one of the players, we don't often get a chance really these days to talk much about Robert Bork. So this is a good occasion. Many of us will recall that he was the Supreme Court nominee who was famously rejected. But he's a player here, too. Can you talk about him and what his role was?
Definitely. No, he to me, was a revelation finding out about Robert Bork. Yes, we knew that in 1987, Antonin Scalia had just before been nominated and confirmed a Reagan appointee. Then the next one was to be Robert Bork, and he was dinged. He was rejected, mainly because 24 years earlier he had written against the 1964 Civil Rights Act on the grounds that every businessman, every person who owns a restaurant is free to serve or not serve whomever they want because it's a free enterprise thing, and that understandably got him rejected as a Supreme Court justice. But apart from that, and we knew he was one of these originalists, which is this conservative reframing of conservatism in the law to say that, no, we should just do only what the Constitution textually says, just as it was understood in 1790 or 1860 or whatever, which was a way to give a kind of fundamentalist justification for what the right wanted to do in every way possible. But the other thing that he did, and I knew nothing about Robert Bork doing this, he was the key guy in changing the way antitrust was considered and interpreted in American jurisprudence. And that sounds kind of boring, and that's why I didn't spend any time thinking about it probably 30 years ago when he was doing it 40 years ago. But he, instead of antitrust and the idea of corporations being too big, being a real problem, as it had been enshrined in American law for a century, that not just a matter of when prices were too high, but when there was too much monopoly or concentrated corporate power, we had a whole set of enforcement systems and laws, the federal level, the state level, to deal with that. Well, he single-handedly changed the way we thought about that and effectively helped eviscerate and emasculate antitrust enforcement in this country with a book he wrote in 1978. Now, his whole career had been, as a scholar, as a Yale Law School guy, had been primarily about antitrust, so he didn't just come out of nowhere and write a book. But it's extraordinary, and again, perfect timing. At this, 1978 was a big year in this shift, and that's when his book came out, and it was quoted in a Supreme Court decision a year after that, and voila, the whole conception of what antitrust law and antitrust enforcement in America had always been was changed.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we want your comments and questions. The number, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling. With help from Camden National Bank's Leaders and Luminaries Awards, celebrating the importance of nonprofit board service. Nominations at camdennational.com. The New School, a high school for change, where students find their voice. thenewschool.org. And CEI, offering short-term reboot financing and advice to help businesses get back on track. CEIMaine.org.
For the first time in modern U.S. history, the Democratic and Republican national conventions will be mostly virtual. Both candidates will accept their party's nominations without the customary spectacle. What does a political convention sound like when so few people can attend? Join us starting Monday, August 17th, for live special coverage from NPR News.
Live coverage of the Democratic Convention starts Monday evening at 9 on Maine Public Radio and 8 o'clock on Maine Public Television.
The coronavirus pandemic has sent the markets crashing and soaring, and it's created new opportunities for illegal insider trading. But NPR has found the Trump administration brought the fewest charges for insider trading in decades.
That means they're not trying. That means they told the cops to go play canasta instead of do their job.
An NPR investigation this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And that's coming up this afternoon at 4 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, a conversation with author and former radio host Kurt Anderson about his new book, Evil Geniuses, The Unmaking of America, A Recent History. As always, we want to hear from you. Email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post to our Facebook page, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. We're talking about Robert Bork. Before the break. So this is an affiliation of somewhat unusual affiliation of, you know, some are corporate heads who are motivated by money. Some are intellectuals who, you know, believe in certain types of economies are superior. Some are libertarians. Was this in some ways, were there some strange bedfellows involved in this effort to remake the American economy?
I guess, sure, there were some strange bedfellows. And the stranger bedfellows, of course, are their political affiliates or allies, which is to say the masses of people who voted for the Republican Party, which is to say often white working class people who aren't either free market ideologues or rich or heads of corporations, but were brought along among in various other ways, which are well known culturally mostly. Yes, there are some strange bedfellows, but not that strange, I would say, in terms of the rich, the ideologues, and big business. They had a pretty a large common goal in terms of giving the rich and business as much wealth and as much power as possible. And again, they were so successful, I think it got out of hand. I don't know that in 1970 and 71, when Lewis Powell and Charles Koch and the rest were planning this, they had any dream of being as successful as they were. But they were successful, and so they kept pushing harder and harder and harder to remake the system politically and economically to serve them. And that's the thing. I mean, it's sort of strange bedfellow-ish, because there are so many disparate dots. And that's what I discovered when I spent the years I spent doing this research, is that look at this, trying to figure out a way in which the things I think do connect and help understand what happened are connected. And there's so many different specifics. There was, for instance, I remember when I began hearing of stock buybacks, where big companies spend tons of money buying their own stock. And I remember thinking at the time when I first heard of it, let's say in the late 80s probably, well, that doesn't seem quite kosher. How can they do that? Isn't that kind of manipulating the market to make the price go up? Well, but it happened more and more and more. And today, most big companies spend most of their profits on doing that. And indeed, most stock purchases are that. So how the heck did that happen? And I look back, there's a little sort of quiet change, relatively not big and controversial at the time, in 1982, that the SEC under Reagan made to say, after that had been effectively illegal for 50 years, they said, nah, go ahead, do it. And if anybody abuses it, we'll deal with it. Well, they haven't ever in the 38 years since gotten on anybody's case for buying back their own stock, and it is now this crazy tail wagging the economy and the stock market. So that's just one example of the thing. Like, who noticed? Who right. noticed that SEC rule change? Unless you were in the business, right? And it has had, as a result, you know, after decades, this enormous effect in how the economy works.
And you would say this happened incrementally in a series of the creation of new norms, right? So even for example, on CEO pay, there was at one point some type of ratio. Maybe the CEO made 50 times what the employees made. But over time, a new normal developed that everybody sort of just accepted.
Right. No, and that wasn't exactly. And that's a great example of a change in norms. It's not a change in a regulation or a change in law. There was no law or regulation that said, as was the case from, let's say, 1940 to 1980, that a CEO shouldn't make any more than 50 or 60 times as much as his or her average employee made. And then, kaboom, it went out of control, first a little slowly in the 80s and then the 90s crazily, so that the average CEO, instead of making 50 or 60 times as much as his or her average employee, made 300 or 400 times, or in some cases, 1,000 times as much as the average employee. So, which is just an incredibly vivid example of how the brakes were taken off, and you know, the famous line from the movie Wall Street in 1987, greed is good, became the actual operating rule of this new paradigm.
And you beat yourself up regularly. I've heard interviews of you sort of saying that you didn't notice. You were a media observer, and you kind of didn't realize. But you also make the point out that many powerful Democrats were sort of, if not complicit, they let it happen. So to that extent, I guess they are to blame. But why was it, do you think, that no one kind of, until the last 10 years or so, said, hey, maybe we should look over here?
A lot of reasons. And most national Democrats, most Democrats, politicians and leaders and thought leaders have some degree of I've done my mea culpa in this book. They could all do them as well. It started in some ways earnestly. It wasn't that they were all bought off exactly, although that became a problem in terms of unregulated campaign funding that we have in this country. But back in the 70s and 80s, people like Gary Hart and Bill Bradley and Bob Kerry and Paul Tsongas and all these kinds of new Democrats were earnestly trying to look at new ways of solving problems. And maybe the market has a place in solving problems, and maybe government can't solve everything. So that's how it began. But they were no match for my evil geniuses, who really had one big idea, which is taxes are bad, government is bad, business is great. Those are our principles, and everything we can do to reinforce them, we'll do. As opposed to this, gee whiz, we liberals have been in charge for a long time. Sure, we're willing to compromise with you, and which led, in the case of liberals and Democrats, to keep compromising to the right as the right kept moving further right on economics. And so we got to a place, I think, in terms of the political ramifications, where people would look, a lot of working people would look, white working people would look at the two parties and say, well, there's not that much difference, really, between these two parties on economics, is there? Why am I going to vote Democrat anymore if they really don't have my back and they're letting unions be crushed and all the rest? And, you know, so in addition to being, I think, mistaken and making our free market system less stable, and in addition to being less fair than it was, politically, the result was people started looking at, well, there's no difference between Democrats and Republicans except on things like abortion rights and other such issues, and so it was a kind of a lose-lose, and the last decade the pendulum, at least in the Democratic Party, I think, has begun swinging back. If you even look at which I recently did at Donald Trump's campaign in 2016. It's remarkable at how much he campaigned as a effectively left-wing economic populist against Wall Street, against the rigged system, against the hedge fund guys getting paid billions of dollars for doing nothing. The whole nine yards. I want to raise taxes. I want to have Medicare for all. And then, of course, the moment he's elected, he does none of that, and he starts doing exactly, except on free trade, what my evil geniuses wish to be done, which is to say giant tax cuts for the wealthy and big business. And, sorry, the rest of you losers who have been losers for 50 years,
yeah. So let's go to the phones now. I'm going to bring in Jennifer, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Jennifer. Welcome to the program.
Hi, I have just a quick comment, and then I have to pop onto Zoom and teach a class. But I, Ed, would like to say, as a Gen Xer who is now in her 50s and was a punk rocker and had a very pragmatic and wonderful grandfather who was like an old school Republican, and the arguments that we used to have when I was a teenager because of what I saw of this switch, and he lived across the street from Governor Curtis and liked Jimmy Carter, and what I saw as greed starting being perpetuated, and then what Newt Gingrich was doing to not allow, say that it was unpatriotic for the two parties to talk to each other. And then there was a person on Terry Gross this week who had been a campaign manager for some of these Republicans, and what he's looking back and saying, oh, it was just all lies. And I just want to thank you. I feel so vindicated for all those arguments. And I love my grandfather to death. But hopefully we will learn from your book and these other things that are coming out now that we've had the time to reflect. And in the future, I know my teenagers are already amped for what most Republicans now would call socialism, and I just call it the 1970s. But
yeah, there you go.
Thank you very much. Jennifer, have a wonderful day.
Thank you, Jennifer. Yeah.
The Republican she refers to is Stuart Stevens, whose book I've read and who I quote in my book, in fact, talking about how he wrote this great piece earlier this year about how the Trump administration and right's response to the pandemic is straight out of what the Republican Party has become. which is disbelieve in science because science says the climate change exists. Well, now it's disbelieve in science because science says you shouldn't open up commerce too quickly, and so forth. And so, no, it has changed. And I, as the son and grandson and son-in-law of old-school Republicans, I feel her on that.
And we don't have time to get into this, but the book that you wrote previous to this really sets up or lays the groundwork for us in the historical context to see American culture as being just throughout since its inception open to fantasy, to conspiracy theories, to the doubt of science. So, in other words, you would argue this is sort of in our societal DNA.
Yeah, that book is Fantasyland, and it was this deep, founding, defining part of the American character and spirit, which is I can believe anything I want, and you can't tell me otherwise. For a long time, that was held in check so that it didn't get out of control, and then it was no longer held in check in the last 40 or 50 years and got out of control. This is the other half of the story of how in my view, we kind of drove ourselves into a ditch. There was that which predisposed a lot of people to believe things that aren't true and have their alternative facts and alternative realities. Then you come along and you get these evil geniuses who want to tell you whatever serves them that isn't true. For instance, climate change is a hoax or climate change doesn't exist. And people could try to do that as they do elsewhere in the developed world. It doesn't play there because Danes and Brits and Canadians have not been don't have quite this American predisposition to believe untrue things because they want to.
All right, we're going to take another quick break, and when we come back, we want to hear from you. Join the conversation with Kurt Anderson. The number 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from First Peer, specializing in Shopify and offering strategic retail and e-commerce solutions in Portland and beyond, firstpeer.com. And Hospice of Southern Maine, caring for patients and families, physically, emotionally, and spiritually, hospiceofsouthernmaine.org.
On August 14, 1939, President Franklin D. Roosevelt made his final trip to Campobello Island. The compound on the island was the summer retreat of Franklin D. and Eleanor Roosevelt, even before he became President of the United States. Roosevelt spent most summers there from 1885 until he was stricken by polio in 1921. He returned for brief visits a few more times, delayed by illness and politics, in the summers of 1933, 1936, and 1939. Now it is home to the Roosevelt Campobello International Park, administered by an international commission once chaired by Edmund Muskie.
On This Day in Maine's History was created in partnership with the Maine Historical Society and made possible through the generous support of Roosevelt Campobello International Park and the Island Institute. Happy birthday, Maine! On the next Speaking in Maine, extremism in the 21st century.
The U.S. is actually not that different from any of these countries that you and I are talking about right now.
Join us for a discussion on the challenge of extremism with Jasmine L. Gamal, Atlantic Council Senior Fellow, and Nick Dowling, founder and CEO of IDS International. This program is from the 2020 College of the Atlantic Champlain Institute, whose theme is November 3rd, What's at Stake? That's Friday afternoon at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Kurt Anderson is my guest today. You may know him as one of the co-founders of Spy Magazine, or as a best-selling author, or from his two decades hosting the public radio program Studio 360. He joins us today to discuss his just-published book, Evil Geniuses, The Unmaking of America, A Recent History. Join the conversation. The number is 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. I want to just bring in a call. We'll go to Anne in Hamden. Hi, Anne. Welcome to the program.
Hi. This is something that I don't understand, and I try to understand, but how did especially white working class people buy into this and support it when really it's to like taking money out of their own pocket, mine? Like, I came from that environment. That's just makes me, I don't understand it.
Okay. Kurt, can you help Ann?
I don't either, Ann. that is one of the $64 trillion questions. It is so, and one of the things I've tried to do with this book is to make it clear to people who may be voting for Republican for other reasons, having to do with nostalgia or having to do with race or having to do with whatever, that these people in these fundamental important ways of how you live and how secure you are and whether your children have a chance to move up the economic ladder and all the rest, they don't have your interest. Not only do they not have your interest, they are against your interest. So, I mean, you used the phrase strange bedfellows earlier, Keith, and it's the strangest. And, you know, coming from a different way, not that I was born rich or anything, but coming at it from a different way, I wanted to find out, like, yeah, what is the deal here? Did this just happen? Is just this just the way the economy is? And no, it isn't. And no, it didn't. And I just feel that the more we can explain it clearly, that my Confederacy, my evil geniuses, are the ones who rigged the system. During the 2016 campaign, when Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump were talking about this rigged system and drain the swamp and all that, I being, you know, a prissy liberal, oh, don't speak in such catchphrases and hyperbole and populist rhetoric. Well, it's more true than it isn't, is the thing, and the system is rigged, and the wrong people are often blamed for that. Some of the right people are blamed, but there's, you know, I can't answer why so many people decide to, as the caller said, vote again and again and again against their own fundamental interests. But it's true.
Do you think is there evidence either coming out of the pandemic experience or in the Sanders campaign or in any of the recent years that you believe the pendulum, this pendulum that has been stuck on one side now for 40 or 50 years, might be moving back? And if so, what kind of force would you think would be needed to get it moving, to nudge it?
I do think, I'm hopeful. I'm 51% hopeful and optimistic. And there are real signs of that. Just that we're having this conversation, that inequality for the last decade has been on the table in the way that it was, that in the Democratic primaries, the question of automation and the fact that jobs are going to, there are not going to be enough jobs because of AI and automation, all these issues are on the table in a way that they weren't a decade. They weren't. So that's good. So I think the discourse is changing, and I believe that, you know, there is something to historical cycles, and we had the 50 years from the New Deal to 1980. That was, you know, the New Deal economic equality era. Then it was switched back in a kind of mirror, go back in time reversal of that around 1980, and here we are. 40 years later, more than 40 years later. So I am hopeful on that grounds too. So yeah, I do see signs, and the fact that and the polling also. I talk in the book a lot about the polling that shows that the belief that we do need government, we do need the federal government to solve some big problems like inequality, for instance, has changed a lot in poll after poll after poll over the last 20 years. That we cannot leave it up to business to do everything, and that, yeah, free market is great, but it's not the answer to everything, and so I am hopeful. I mean, of course, the my evil geniuses and all of their various institutions, you know, in finance, in media, and the rest, will not give up easily. But you know, I just noticed one of my evil genius cabals is this thing called the Business Roundtable that was created in the early 70s by the CEOs of the 200 biggest companies, and they were key to this whole what I describe in evil geniuses. They last fall came out with a new statement saying, you know, companies do have to care about things other than profits and share prices. You know, big companies do have to care about equity and equality and inequality and all the rest. That may be just lip service, and I think it in significant measure is, but the fact that they felt they had to do that is a good sign.
Yeah,
so we'll see. You know, talk to me on November 4th, and I'll either my hopefulness will be up to 52% or not.
All right, we'll call you back. Dave is calling from Waterboro. Dave, just a few minutes left. Briefly, if you could, please. Thanks.
Sure, I'll be very quick. I used to work in broadcasting in the early 80s and through the 90s until 99 before I became a teacher. And I've been commenting for a long time on the fact, and this program is both enlightening and alarming, and I feel kind of vindicated but alarmed at the same time, in that early in the Reagan administration, we saw the disappearance of the fairness doctrine, which I thought was horrible and upset me. And then this thing started changing with media ownership, and it was a very drastic change in terms of ownership, who could own what, when, and where, and how many different stations, and all this stuff. But now I see it as part of a... I don't know if you talk about the Confederacy, how it played into it, but without their control of the media, they could not have been anywhere near as successful as they have been. And I'm just curious what our guest thinks.
All right, Dave, thank you. Kurt?
No, that's a great point. Both the end of the Fairness Doctrine, which allowed the incredible rise of talk radio, even before there was an internet that probably would have mooted the Fairness Doctrine, but not for another decade or more. So that's a good point. And again, until I did the research for this book, I wasn't aware, because I hadn't gone back and looked at like how it happened, of just in the case of Rupert Murdoch and the Fox and Murdoch conservative media empire, how again and again, both by the Reagan administration and then by the first George Bush administration, the rules were changed to allow him to own newspapers and television stations in one city, Boston being one of them, to allow a foreign person, Rupert Murdoch, to have an easier time of it owning television stations, which had been previously illegal, and so on and so forth. It wasn't just it didn't just happen. It was the right serving the right, so this right-wing media enterprise could serve them. I mean, again, I try not to be too simplistic in how I depict it. But when you do the research, it's hard not to say, "Yep, it looks and walks and quacks like a duck." I guess that's a duck. It's kind of a conspiracy of the rich and powerful to reinforce their wealth and power.
About 30 seconds left. Is there another book after this?
Oh, unless I die tomorrow, Keith. Yeah.
I guess
yeah,
I mean,
well,
will
I
it be a tr-
another book?
Is it a trilogy?
This is kind of I think my 2-volume history of modern America, Fantasyland, and now Evil Geniuses: The Unmaking of America. I think I had my other previous four books had been novels, and I'm looking forward to getting back into the fiction writing world. I think I've said most of what I have to say certainly on this subject.
Well, since Americans love fiction, I'm sure they'll love your next book as well.
There you go. There you go.
Kurt Anderson, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Kurt Anderson was the host and co-creator of Studio 360. The show won Peabody Awards for broadcast excellence in both 2005 and 2013. As an editor, Kurt co-founded the transformative satirical magazine Spy. And we've been discussing his just-published book, Evil Geniuses, The Unmaking of America, A Recent History. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Today's Maine Calling program will be rebroadcast at 7. And you can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as helpful links and resources by visiting mainecalling.org. Our theme music was written by Mike Jandro. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling. on Maine Public Radio. Have a great weekend.